You're listening to 91.3 WLRN. The following topical occurrence is a rebroadcast, so no phone calls and no emails.
And it is today's topical occurrence. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you on this Tuesday edition. How was your holiday, Bonnie?
Well, it was spent reading.
Quite a bit of rain that we had.
Quite a bit of reading about the unconscious.
Oh, yes, I did too. Had a lot of fun doing that. Well, this hour we visit with physicist, author, and screenwriter Leonard Mlodinow. Is that correct?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Mlodinow. And he's co-authored books with both Stephen Hawking and Deepak Chopra. And his latest work is Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. And he joins us from Southern California Public Radio in Pasadena. Welcome again, Leonard.
Thanks.
And good to have you. So I'm kind of mystified if our social and sensory perceptions are mostly illusory, if our memories are largely inaccurate, all being the products of constructs of unconscious processes in our brains, then what actually constitutes reality?
Well, that's a very good question. The reality that we perceive is constructed both by our conscious mind and by our unconscious mind. And the point of writing the book was that obviously people know about the conscious influences that work on them, but they tend to be unaware of the unconscious influences because obviously they're beyond our awareness. But unless you study them or read about them, you don't really know what's going on in your mind. And in the last 10 or 20 years, scientists have started a whole new field called social neuroscience, the subject of which is to understand how our unconscious mind is working. And they found that it's much different than the traditional ideas of Freud and others.
So we tend to enhance versions of ourselves to justify many decisions.
Well, one of the things that your unconscious mind does for you is it gives you it buttresses your opinion of yourself. And the reason that it does that is that in life today, and as we were evolving in the wild, we face many daunting obstacles. And it's very important for our survival that we would keep going, keep pushing, that we would have an optimistic outlook. And so one of the things your unconscious mind does for you is it gives you an optimistic outlook, or at least a more optimistic outlook of things than you would have if you were a pure realist. Scientists have found, in fact, that the people with the most realistic views of themselves are depressed people. And the rest of us tend to have an inflated view of ourselves. The most exaggerated one, which I love, is our high school students. There was a survey of 3 million high school students which asked them a number of questions, one of which was, are you above average? And guess, rounded to the percent, how many of them thought they were above average?
90-something?
100.
100%. And the professors that they asked didn't do much better. They asked professors in a survey, is your research above average? And 94% thought it was. So, you know, what happens is that what your brain does for you in this case is that as you're taking in data and analyzing whether it's a business decision or a political issue or data about your own character, there are certain ways that you have to choose to analyze it. One is when you get data that comes in, you have to decide what weight to give it. You also have to decide whether it's credible or not. So there are a number of meta issues, let's say, that affect the way you process data. And what your unconscious mind does is it makes you act as an attorney rather than a scientist. A scientist is supposed to look at the data and be completely objective and then come to a conclusion. An attorney is supposed to have to look at the conclusion that he or she wants to reach and then work backwards to find the evidence that supports that. And scientists have found that that's the way your thinking works in an unconscious level. So it's not that people say to themselves, I want to conclude this, that death penalty is good or death penalty is bad or I'm talented or I'm not talented. We all know, you know, what we want to conclude, but we don't think that we're judging the data in a biased way based on that. We think we're being objective. But in truth, when we look at the data, we make these decisions of what to weigh and what to poke holes in an unconscious level in a way that tends to lead toward the conclusion that we want to reach.
I'd like to get back a little to Freud and just ask if this is all true, these discoveries in the last 15 years, this social neuroscience, does it mean that classic psychotherapy is a tool for unlocking the unconscious is ineffective at best and obsolete at worst? I mean, at least for psychotherapists.
When you talk to researchers, they tend not to want to talk too much about Freud. The bottom line is that there is no evidence for most of Freud's theories. Freud was correct in the big picture that the unconscious mind has a great influence on us, and for instance, on our sense of who we are and our sense of worth. But in the details where they've looked, they've found very little evidence that he was correct on specific issues like the Oedipal complex and other things that he talked about.
All right.
So in particular, what scientists have found using brain imaging in the last 10, 15 years is that the unconscious processes that we're talking about go on in parts of your brain that are inherently inaccessible to your conscious mind, so that psychotherapy and introspection will not access them. You can't learn about what they are by thinking about it and analyzing yourself. So in that sense, his approach seems to have been incorrect. And of course, Freud wasn't a scientist. He started out as a scientist, but he spent most of his career as a clinician. And so the ideas and techniques that he developed, he never really tested in the lab. And he has a lot of followers. But these ideas are not the same. They're very different from the ideas that scientists have been discovering in the last 10, 20 years.
Is there an evolutionary scheme behind this real strong unconsciousness?
Right. Well, sure. So we might ask, we tend to emphasize when we talk about the unconscious mind today that the illusions, what we call cognitive illusions, which are analogous to optical illusions. But the truth is that for the most part, your conscious mind is a great gift to you, and you need the conscious mind in order to survive. That's why it evolved. Your unconscious mind takes charge of, first of all, some things that you need to just live, beating of your heart, your breathing. It also does a lot of higher-level processing that you're not aware of that is crucial to your interacting with the environment. For instance, when you look at a scene, what your retinas of your eyes pick up is really a very fuzzy picture. If I were to show you an image of literally what your retinas picked up, you would think that was a really lousy photo. In fact, there's an example in the book. And what your unconscious mind does is it takes that data and it processes it and it sharpens it and it makes it three-dimensional instead of two-dimensional. And it does all this behind the scenes. This is nothing that you could even do. Even if you were a physicist with a computer, it would take you a long time to write a program to sharpen up the image, just like, let's say, as Photoshop does for you. And your unconscious mind is doing that all the time, and you're not aware of it. It's automatic, and it takes no effort on your part. And it does the same with hearing, and it does the same with smell and all your senses. And it does the same with judging data about financial decisions or about people. In general, your unconscious mind is taking in a lot of data that your conscious mind doesn't have the bandwidth to analyze, and it's presenting you with a constructed reality that really comes from your imagination. It comes from the real data that's there, plus a lot of background processing. And it seems to us to be real, just like when you look out at a scene, the scene seems to be a sharp, clear picture. The same thing happens when we judge people or we judge financial situations. We think we have a sharp, clear idea of it, but really a lot of that is influenced by unconscious processing.
So does that mean that we're largely out of control of our social and sensory perceptions?
Well, let me give you an example. So rather than I've been talking very, very generally, give an idea of what I'm talking about. Touch, for instance. Touch is a way that all primates interact and form social alliances and bond with each other and create trust. In other primates, they may spend an hour or two a day grooming each other, you know, picking insects and dirt out of each other's hair. Even though they only need to spend about 20 minutes to complete the process, they do it as a bonding exercise. And humans have developed beyond that. It's a lot more subtle with humans, but it's still there. And one of the kinds of data you take in about someone is touch. And it, just as it does in other primates, when people touch each other, even a very brief, light touch it creates a feeling of trust and bonding. And
or a handshake. Example, or a handshake.
Or a handshake. And one example is of a study that was done was waiters and waitresses were asked to, as they were interacting with their customers, to give a light quarter to half second touch on the shoulder or the elbow to their customers, to half their customers, and not to the other half. And they found that the servers who touched their customers got on average 30% more tips than the ones who didn't touch
wow.
the customers. So, and in other contexts, it's worked equally well. People, they've done research on people who are doing mall surveys and ask you to stop and take 5 minutes of your time. And people who were not touched, 40% of them agreed to take the survey. And when they were touched, 60% agreed. And in a very interesting study in France, of course, they studied romance. They put handsome young actors on street corners on a sunny afternoon and asked them to proposition all the single young women who walked by and try and get their phone numbers. And it was a controlled study, so the actors were not winging it. They were actually reciting a script that they had memorized. And to half of the young women they propositioned, they gave them this very light touch. Again, that's not a grope, not a huge bear hug. A touch that people later, when they were asked in exit interviews, tended either not to remember or to have noticed. And they increased their success from 10% to 20%. So in many different contexts, the touch has been shown to influence people. And the point is, it's an unconscious influence. It's not that you say, you know, when it happens, I feel a bond with this person, or the person touched me, I like that. It's something that people deny is affecting them or don't even remember happened, and yet it affects their decision-making.
We're speaking...
Another example?
Yes, please, go ahead.
One other example comes to mind from in a totally different realm. Your mood has a big effect on you, and unconscious things in your environment can affect your mood. In England, in a grocery store, agreed to participate in research. They had a wine aisle that sold both French and German wines. And they agreed on alternate days to play very soft music, either French or German music. And on the days they played French music, they sold 2/3 French wine. And on the days they played German music, they sold 2/3 German wine. And again, in exit interviews, people either didn't remember or notice the music, or else they claimed that it didn't affect their decision. They thought they were looking at the wine bottles, taking in real data, you know, what kind of wine is it, where is it from, what's the vineyard, and they were you know, weighing the data and making a decision based on their preferences in the data. But in reality, they were being influenced by the music in the background. It was a subliminal influence. That's why I call the book subliminal, because these are things that happen around us all the time that change the way we think, feel, and make decisions.
We're speaking with Leonard Mlodinow. He's a theoretical physicist, screenwriter, and author, and professor at Caltech. And his latest book is Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. And it has another name, too. The other name is Psst. Hey there. Yes, you sexy. Buy this book now. You know you want it.
You have to look for that, though, and hold it to the light properly.
Yes.
It's a subliminal message on the cover itself.
Yes, exactly. You can see it if you hold... Yeah, it needs to catch the light correctly. And then the back of it says, buy, buy, buy. Anyway, we need to take a short break on Topical Currents. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Subliminal Edition. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. And via Twitter, @TopicalCurrents. Leonard Mlodinow, author of Subliminal. Tell me... The old thing we used to call, probably thought it was urban legend, about the movie theaters in the old days sticking in quick snatch of boxes of popcorn or a Coke to try and get us subliminally to buy them. Uh-huh. Was that correct? Or?
Well, okay, so that was a hoax that was perpetrated in the late 50s when the whole mood of the country was very much... worried about
paranoid.
The Cold War, paranoid, brainwashing. And this fellow who had a marketing business claimed that by inserting one frame into a film that says drink Coke or eat popcorn, he would get people to do those things. And scientists in about the last 10, 12 years have done a couple studies on that and found that there was a very minor effect that might get someone to might influence a choice, but it's not really going to change anything where you're going to get Coke where you really prefer Sprite or something like that. It's really a fragile, short-lasting, and not very effective way of doing things. But it did get the subliminal message, the idea of subliminal influence into the consciousness of the public. But I chose that title for the book because I thought that even though that particular method doesn't work, that's what's really happening, is there are all kinds of subliminal influences in our environment is affecting us through our unconscious, affecting the way that we behave and think. So it's interesting. He kind of had the right direction, maybe a little bit like Freud, but not quite the right technique.
If so many of our assumptions about ourselves and society are false, when can we trust ourselves to know the truth? I mean, should we trust our instincts? What should we trust?
Well, you know, I mean, when you look when you look out into the world, even though a lot of what you perceive that you see is a construction of your unconscious mind, it doesn't mean that it's wrong. You know, it's only wrong on occasion, and that's why we have what we call optical illusions. But for the most part, it's right. But still, there's a lot. It's not really what's there. Let me give you a dramatic example of something called blindsight. There are people who've had strokes in the visual cortex and that obliterates their conscious sensation of sight, and yet there are parts of their unconscious processing that are unaffected. And so these people can see things without knowing it. And so if you take someone like that whose eyes are intact and the unconscious processing parts of the brain are intact but they're conscious or not, you can, for instance, toss them a ball and they'll catch it and they'll have no idea why they reacted that way or how they knew to do that. Or you lead them down a hall, they will avoid obstacles instinctively without knowing why. They'll just have a feeling, I better step to the left here. So, you know, you're not aware of a lot of the things that are going on out there, but they're doing, your mind is doing that processing to help you, and only on occasion do you get things wrong. So if you're in the wine aisle, as I talked about, you know, your mind is taking in all this data, including the music. And in this case, if you happen to not like German wines and you bought it on a whim and you didn't realize it was the music, that would be a cognitive illusion or a mistake that you made. But for the most part, your unconscious mind is helping you.
So you call it a gift, but can it be detrimental? I mean, when we do the categorization and stereotyping, and it's not always a gift, is it?
Well, that's a perfect example. So let's look at categorization. You need to categorize in order to survive in our environment. Just to take a very silly example, there was a fellow who had a stroke in a part of his brain that affected his categorization ability, and when he was asked to set the table, he couldn't sort the knives, the forks, and the spoons, because to him each fork was an individual, unique object. And if he had another fork, he had to stand there and figure out that they're the same thing. He didn't automatically categorize them, stereotype them, and go, oh, it has these general qualities. It's a fork. This is a knife. And so if we didn't have this ability to automatically and unconsciously categorize things, we would have a hard time out in the world. On the other hand, it has its detrimental side, which is when we categorize people by, let's say, their religion or their skin color or their sexual orientation. And we do that also automatically without realizing it, in the same way that we categorize knives and forks. And we sometimes assign negative traits and have a bias against these groups because we're constantly bombarded by stereotypes from the media, from TV and movies and magazines. And when you're constantly bombarded by certain traits that are associated with a group, and when you see a member of that group and your mind automatically categorizes, you tend to have and act toward that person in that manner. And it's something that even people who are very anti-discrimination and very conscious of trying not to discriminate will, when they judge people, experiments have shown, will, when they judge people, take into account, let's say, race and racial stereotypes. There's a very interesting test you can take to test yourself. It's at it's called the Implicit Association Test, or IAT. And if you type into Google IAT in Harvard, you'll get to it. It's at harvard.edu website. And it's a computer test that's been developed that can test your unconscious prejudices. And what people find is that even, for instance, a fair percentage of black people have biases against black people. Gay people have biases about gay people. It's something that you really can't avoid. And it's the cognitive illusion side of the gift of categorizing.
What does IAT stand for?
Implicit Associations Test, because
okay.
It tests your implicit bias by giving you certain associations that you have to come up with.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying it's a very interesting and revealing test, some people have famously taken it and discovered things about themselves that they didn't know. For instance, there was one gay activist who took it and was shocked to see that he had a fair degree of bias about gay people. Mm. So it's an example of the split between your conscious thinking and your unconscious biases. But I mean, when people send out resumes, for instance, that are identical, but have one trait changed, black versus white, or woman versus man, then you can see very clearly these unconscious biases in action, because you'll send them to people who believe that they are, treating the resumes fairly, and you look statistically at how many, what the judgments are of the same resume, the one that says woman or man, and you'll see huge differences. In my own field in physics, for instance, a study was done where research proposals were sent out to be evaluated, and these were dummy proposals that were sent out, and the only difference was some people saw that the same proposal with a woman's name and some with a man's name, and the men's were judged significantly better.
Mm.
And the people who are making these judgments are often horrified that they've, if they're told that they've done that, because they don't know that they've done that. They really don't know themselves that well, because these are things that are working on a insidious level beneath your threshold of consciousness.
How does the unconscious affect the term that we hear a lot of cognitive dissonance? Or does it?
Well, cognitive dissonance was an old psychological term that is today called, for the most part, it's a related term that's used, is called motivated reasoning. And in motivated reasoning is the reason that I was talking about earlier. When you see something that doesn't quite click with the way you think things should be or you want them to be, your mind finds ways to massage the data to make it work for you. So, for instance, in one study, people were shown the data from a court trial, a civil trial, where a motorcyclist was suing an automobile driver, and they analyzed all the data, and they were told they were going to take either one part or another, one side or the other side, in a mock negotiation. And just before they went into the negotiation, they were told, wait a minute, before you go and negotiate, I want you to take off your advocate's hat and be objective. And if you can guess within $5,000 what the actual settlement was, then we'll give you $50. And they told them the settlement was between $0 and $100,000. So the people were now motivated to look at the data like a scientist and not like an attorney. But they couldn't do it. The people who were taking the side of the defendant guessed on average that $20,000 was enough for this. And those who had looked at the data thinking they were going to be on the side of the plaintiff guessed $40,000. So the fact that they had a motive, which was now taken away, affected the way that they analyzed the data.
We're speaking with Leonard Mlodinow. He's a theoretical physicist and teacher at Caltech. And his latest book is Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. And that's Topical Currents. We're going to take some calls.
Leonard, just before we do that, quickly, tell us about the screenwriting and TV writing business side of you.
Well, that's something I don't do too much of anymore, but I wrote for television for about 8 years. I did some comedies like Night Court and the Gary Shandling Show, the old one. I worked on MacGyver and Star Trek The Next Generation. I've done since then a couple of IMAX. I've done the script for a couple of IMAX films, which haven't been made yet. And so I did have that side of me, because I've, in addition to being a passionate about science and loving physics and mathematics, I've always loved to write. So I've found ways in my career to combine those things.
Hmm. And you always come back to science, it seems.
Yeah, I do. I consider my identity myself as a physicist, and even though now I mostly spend my time writing books, I do still do physics research in my spare time, and luckily I'm a theoretical physicist, so I don't have to have a lab or money to do that, just a pad of paper and some ideas, so I do that. But mostly I try to, I write books on topics that I think are interesting to people and that can spread the gospel of science.
Let's take a call or two. First up, it's Freddie. He's in Miami. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. And thank you for taking my call. Appreciate your guest. It's a lot of science going on the radio this afternoon. We'd like to ask your guest, how is the data gathered to support the subliminal mind? I mean, if we have a broken bone, we can do diagnostic tests such as x-rays. If we have a tumor, we can use blood labs and MRIs and what have you to come to a conclusion that data exists. What about the subliminal mind? And my second question would be, assuming you gather the data with good diagnostic tools, what happens in a state of coma? Do we still have this subliminal mind processing its surroundings? And I'll take my answer, and I'll wait for a response.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frenny.
Okay, well, those are both good questions. Let me start with take the first question first. Social neuroscience is a combination, really, of three sciences. Two of them are behavioral sciences, social psychology, which studies how people interact with each other, and cognitive psychology, which studies how people think. And so the studies of the unconscious from those sciences are done via behavioral studies. For instance, the music study that I told you about. And in those studies, they pretty much have to rely on what people say. So you play the music in the two aisles, the French music or the German music. You see how much wine is being bought. And you ask people on their way out, did you hear the music? Do you remember the music? Did it affect your decision? And if they say it didn't, then you assume that it's the unconscious. And, of course, that's a little bit squishy. And so the reason that the new science is so exciting is that the neuroscience contribution is through high-tech new techniques, and one of the most important, or probably the most important right now, is called fMRI, or functional magnetic resonance imaging. And that's the same as the MRI your doctor does to look at your internal parts, except for the F in front. Functional refers to an added twist, which is when they look at your brain with this technology, the scientists can actually see what part of your brain is operating at any given time. So they can actually see what part of your brain is connected with your feelings, your thoughts, your perceptions. And so to give you an example of how they combine these two and how that has really increased the scientific level of all these studies, let me give you an example of Coke versus Pepsi. People on blind taste tests tend to prefer Pepsi. And when they know what they're drinking, they tend to prefer Coke. And if you ask people, does the brand affect you? People say no. Or do the ads affect you? Are the ads the reason you like Coke versus Pepsi? They deny it. So you think, well, it must be affecting them on an unconscious level. And that's all you can do if you can't look into the brain. But then scientists have gone farther now with the brain imaging technology, and they've had people actually do these taste tests while they're having their brains imaged. And what they find is that when they're having the Pepsi and they're enjoying it, certain parts of their brain that are associated with the taste are lighting up, and the same parts of the brain light up when they're enjoying the Coke. But the difference is that when they're enjoying the Coke and they know that it's Coke, other parts of the brain that are associated with like a warm, fuzzy feeling that you would get from all those years of commercials that, you know, things go better with Coke, I'd like to give the World of Coke, have a Coke and a smile, all very happy ads. Those light areas light up too. So the scientists can see exactly on an unconscious level how the how those ads are working to change people's perception of the taste. And another very interesting study with wine, they studied people who were tasting wines that were labeled with different prices. And in particular, there was one that was $90 and one that was $10, and they enjoyed the $90 wine more. And it turned out that the researchers were sneaky, and they had put the $90 bottle in the $10 wine in the $10 bottle as well. And when you asked people if they were enjoying the $90 bottle more because of the price, they would deny that. But again, when they did the wine tasting in the while their brains were being imaged, they could see that they really were enjoying the $90 bottle more if they knew it was $90. So I tell people, buy one expensive bottle of wine, enjoy it, and from then on in, take your cheap wine and pour it into there, and your guests will love it just as much.
He also wanted to know about the unconscious in coma.
So a coma is a state of unconsciousness that lasts more than, I don't know, let's say 6 hours, and where you can't be, you don't respond to normal stimuli like light or sound or pain. And there's a lot of different states of coma and levels of being comatose. And I'm not a physician, so I don't want to get into the issue of when is someone really still alive or not. But you know, unconscious processing can, in some cases, still be going on. And in some cases, of course, unconscious mind is always at work. As long as your heart is beating, that's taking care of that. So it depends, you know, what you're talking about, whether the person can process hearing or seeing. And so I don't want, you know, not being a physician, I don't can't really get into the details about that. But your unconscious mind is at work as long as your body is functioning. And what higher level unconscious processing is going on is really, I think, something that is you have to look at on a case-by-case basis.
I have a question about the fMRIs. Can mental illness be studied using them, and have there been any breakthroughs on that front with them?
Well, that's a good question. And so far, there's been real progress in trying to understand how the brain is working in certain ways, with, you know, and to figure out what is causing certain modes of behavior. But the direct connection, the leap from the parts of brains that are working and the chemicals in the brain to the mental illness, you know, is sometimes hard to make. But a lot of diseases, and not just mental illness, diseases like autism, for instance, are being studied, and we're learning a lot about them by learning better about how the brain operates.
Hmm. I had a question about your mom. You talk about her experience and how she, how she was influenced unconsciously by being a Holocaust survivor. I don't know if she's still, is she still alive?
She is. She's 92.
Oh, my. But what I'm interested in knowing is if any unconscious effects that may have had on your life, your perceptions, and your judgments.
Wow. Well, that's quite a question. I think it's, sorry, you're going to say something else?
No. Well, that's what interested me.
I think it's had a huge effect on me. One thing is, you know, growing up, my father didn't talk about his experiences too much, but there was a short period where he did, and I have some hours of tapes with him talking about his experiences, and he was in the underground, the anti-Nazi underground, and then in the Buchenwald concentration camp. Right. And to hear some of the ordeals that he and my mother both survived, and multiple times. I mean, there's so many near-death experiences or encounters that it's almost hard to believe it, that it could be true. And the only way that I know how to look at it is something that physicists call the anthropic principle, which is that the chances are very slim that any person could survive, let's say, a dozen of such close calls with brushes with death. And for any particular person, that would be unlikely that they would survive. And in fact, over 90% of the Jews in Poland didn't survive. But now I'm looking at a different population. You're looking at the ones who did survive. And so the fact that we know that they did survive means that it's not so far-fetched that they would have survived all these brushes with death, because they all, the Jews then had a lot of brushes with death. And the ones that survived are the ones that had that luck of surviving all those things. And so when I look at my own life and I have my own issues, challenges to face, I know I feel a certain perspective that I think other people don't feel, knowing, you know, that you could be a wealthy person with servants. My mother had my mother's family. My father's was poor. My mother's was wealthy. They had a cook, for instance. And one day you could be living that kind of life. The next day you could be licking puddles for water. And I know not to take it all that seriously, whatever good comes, and also whatever bad comes, to know that it could be a lot worse. And that's just an eternal feeling that I have. It's not something that I'll sometimes say it to myself consciously, but I know that it's something that just affects on an unconscious level my outlook on the world.
And that example you give about your mom and, you know, trying to reach you and she couldn't reach you and she thought you were dead, and you said that's because she thought she could lose everything at any given moment. Do you feel that way too?
Not as much as her. That example you gave was when I used to call her in graduate school once a week, and one time I was late calling her. I was out on a date or something, and so she called my roommate and started calling and calling and calling and badgering, and was certain that my roommate was hiding my death, because she was that insecure, because she had gone through that where she had lost everything instantly. And I don't have that quite as much, but I have that. I am more as a parent with children. I do occasionally go there and feel almost like my mother did, when it really isn't warranted. But that's what I use my conscious mind to, my knowledge of the unconscious and my knowledge of myself through the unconscious. I use my conscious mind with that knowledge to try to overrule and check my feelings and tell myself, this is just you, Leonard. This is, you know, this is your, you know, your history talking. It's not something that's really, you know, likely. It's not, you know, you're being unreasonable. You're jumping to conclusions. So that's really why I wrote The Subliminal, because I think in all these areas, if you're aware that these influences can happen, then you can use your conscious mind to mitigate them or overrule them.
I want to talk more about that. We need to take a break. We're speaking with Leonard Mlodinow. He's a theoretical physicist and author of many books. His latest book is Subliminal: How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. We're going to take that short break, and we'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with Leonard Mlodinow. He's the author of Subliminal: How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. Leonard, you co-wrote a book with Stephen Hawking. What was that experience like?
That was an amazing experience on many levels. One, of course, to work with someone so brilliant. Secondly, to really have to learn patience because of his difficulties in communicating. As I'm sure your listeners know, he can't speak, but he kind of speaks through a computer by clicking a mouse to select certain letters and words, and it's a very slow process. And these days he clicks with his by twitching his cheek. It's like a mouse click while a cursor flies across the screen. Either he catches a letter, or once he's caught the first letter or the first two letters of a word, he gets choices of words. And anyway, by clicking at the right time, he can select the letters and words that he needs. And when we were working together, he was about six words a minute. So you can imagine that the conversations were long. And so in between, when I would say something and I would get his response, you would have in those days maybe 10 minutes or 15 minutes to sit there and meditate. And I really did. I actually, you'd think you could do other things, read, work, do your work. But I, partly out of respect for him and partly just because it was my instinct, I would sit there and think about what I had said, what he might be saying, or what we're talking about. And it was a very, very interesting experience, because we worked together for several years very closely. I would go out to Cambridge a couple times a year for a few weeks, or he would come here. He comes to Caltech every year for about a month. And in between, we would email. And so it was a fascinating experience. You know, one thing I have to say, it was a big help to me, his difficulties communicating, because it would also give me time to catch up with his thinking. So in that sense, it was a gift. So it's funny how a lot of things that you think in life are bad are really gifts. And Stephen would claim that his illness was a gift in many ways, because he thinks he's a far better physicist because it helped him to focus on his work. And, of course, he was always dedicated, I think, principally to his work. And and having this disability really helped him to, you know, to focus on it.
Well, I'd like to turn to memory and how much our memory uses the unconscious to fill in the blanks. Joe's interested in that you talk about the John Dean testimony, but I'm interested also if you could weave it into how eyewitness accounts are very perilous in the criminal justice system.
Right. Related question. So one of the things I would like to get across in our talk today is that the reality that you perceive is a construction of your mind, that you take in limited data and your mind fills in blanks and massages it to give you a perception of something that's going on. And that works the same way in memory. In memory, you don't have the capacity to remember every bit of data that you've ever experienced, that your eyes have taken in or that you've heard. If you were to remember everything, it would fill up your brain, and it would also make the finding of memories very difficult, because, for instance, if you saw a person's face, you wouldn't categorize that this is a person. You would remember that this is Joe or Bonnie. You would remember this is that person from this angle, from that angle, with this lighting, with that lighting. You'd have 10,000 different images of that person to sort through when you ran into that person again. So what you do is you remember limited data, just like your retinas pick up limited data from the outside world, and your mind paints the picture and fills in the blanks. Now, when it fills in the blanks, it makes educated guesses. You remember the gist of what happened, and you fill in the blanks based on your expectations, based on your beliefs, based on even your desires, which is maybe an unfortunate aspect of it. But it takes this and it fills it in. So what happened, for instance, in the John Dean case was John Dean was had all these conversations with Nixon and during the Watergate.
And he seemed so encyclopedic fiasco. In his testimony.
He seemed when the Congress called him before them to testify, he seemed encyclopedic. They called him the human tape recorder, right? He had such a clear recollections of everything that happened. Well, then what happened was it came out that Nixon had been taping this. And so we had a non-human tape recorder to compare the human tape recorder to. And it turned out that he was wrong about everything, almost everything, virtually all the details. What he got right was the gist of most of what happened, although it was a tainted gist based on his motivated reasoning of wanting to look good and feel good about himself.
Right.
And so this has been studied in great detail. Now, the other case, the other example, which is an eyewitness testimony, is not quite as humorous as the John Dean case, and a lot is actually tragic and a very important issue in our criminal justice system. And that is that when you look at someone, if you're looking at a stranger who's perpetrating a crime, the same thing is in effect, that you remember the gist of the face, not all the details. So what happens is if you are exposed later to a lineup, whether it's a lineup of real people or a photo lineup, you have the expectation and even the belief perhaps that the police, have caught the person, and that's one of the people in the lineup. That's number one. You're just going in with that as a setup. And, of course, you probably have the desire that you want to find the person. And these are working on an unconscious level, of course. I'm not saying you're saying to yourself, I'm going to pick one no matter what because I want them found. Your unconscious mind is twisting the way you're analyzing the data. Now you look at these people, and if it happens that all but one don't look anything like the person, but that one other person has the gist of their face, kind of the general features look somewhat like that person, you can be fooled into sincerely believing that is the person. And one case I talk about in my book was a case of rape where the woman had the fortitude to study the person's rapist's face during the crime, and she escaped, tricked him and managed to escape. and was presented with one of these lineups, was a little bit unsure at first, but said, I think it's that guy. And as soon as the police said, you picked him, she said she felt as if she had just gotten an 800 on the SAT. And after that, she was asked again and again to identify him, of course, in the trial, for instance. And every time subsequently she was asked, she was more and more certain because, of course, now she's identifying not the original guy, but the guy that, you know, that she originally picked, because that became the new face. And the more she saw it, the more she remembered the face. And it got so bad that what happened was there was another trial because the real rapist confessed to a friend in prison. That got back to the authorities, and they granted a new trial to the guy who was originally convicted. The judge in the new trial stood the person who had confessed right next to the person that she had originally picked out and asked her, which of these is it? And she was still convinced it was the guy she picked out. That's how certain she was, because your false memories can be clear as a whistle. It's just because your memory is clear doesn't mean it's real. So she picked him out. He went back to jail but he ended up in jail for a total of 17 years before DNA testing became possible. They tested the evidence that was still left over from the act and found that it was indeed the guy who had confessed, and this guy that she had picked was let out. And she felt horrible about it, wrote a book about it with that guy, and crusaded for a while against eyewitness testimony. But this is the mechanism that happens, is that
Okay. How about a website where people can learn more about you?
They can just, if they just Google me, MLODINOW, and they'll find me, or they can put that in plus Caltech or plus Subliminal. I mean, they can just find me online.
Very good. Leonard Mlodinow. And the book is Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior.
Thank you very much. And that is our program for today. We thank you so much for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction and production assistance from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow, we are at your service with Condo and Homeowner Association issues with Community Association Attorney Donna Berger of the law firm of Becker and Polyakov. Bonnie Berman joining you and sending best wishes to Joseph Cooper for his speedy recovery, and hoping your day is a very good one. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.